He supposedly was a French-speaking businessman living in Singapore, representing a collective of American importers from New York to California. The truth is he had been dismissed by the collective, which then tried to have him extradited back to the States for prosecution. He had stolen hundreds of thousands from it. He was known in Singapore as a reclusive figure, very powerful in contraband operations, and extraordinarily ruthless. "Before that," interrupted Jason, feeling again the perspiration breaking out on his hairline. "Before Singapore, where did he come from?" "Be careful. The images." He could see the streets of Singapore. Prince Edward Road, Kim Chuan, Boon Tat Street, Maxwell, Cascaden. Those are the records no one can find. There are only rumors, and they are meaningless. For example, it was said that he was a defrocked Jesuit, gone mad. Another speculation was that he had been a young, aggressive investment banker caught embezzling funds in concert with several Singapore banks. There's nothing concrete, nothing that can be traced. Before Singapore, nothing. You're wrong. There was a great deal. But none of that is part of it. There is a void, and it must be filled, and you can't help me. Perhaps no one can. Perhaps no one should. So far you haven't told me anything startling, said Bourne. Nothing relative to the information I'm interested in.
Then I don't know what you want. You ask me questions, press for details, and when I offer you answers, you reject them as immaterial. What do you want?
What do you know about Kane's work? Since you're looking for a compromise, give me a reason for it. If our information differs, it would be over what he's done, wouldn't it? When did he first come to your attention? Carlos' attention. Quickly!
2 years ago, said Madame Lavier, disconcerted by Jason's impatience, annoyed, frightened. Word came out of Asia of a white man offering a service astonishingly similar to the one provided by Carlos. He was swiftly becoming an industry. An ambassador was assassinated in Moulmein. 2 days later, a highly regarded Japanese politician was killed in Tokyo prior to a debate in the Diet. A week after that, a newspaper editor was blown out of his car in Hong Kong, and in less than 48 hours, a banker was shot on a street in Calcutta. Behind each one, Kane. Always Kane.
The woman stopped, appraising Bourne's reaction. He gave none.
Don't you see? He was everywhere. He raced from one kill to another, accepting contracts with such rapidity that he had to be indiscriminate. He was a man in an enormous hurry, building his reputation so quickly that he shocked even the most jaded professionals. And no one doubted that he was a professional, least of all Carlos. Instructions were sent. Find out about this man. Learn all you can. You see, Carlos understood what none of us did, and in less than 12 months he was proven correct. Reports came from informers in Manila, Osaka, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. Kane was moving to Europe, they said. He would make Paris itself his base of operations. The challenge was clear. The gauntlet thrown. Kane was out to destroy Carlos. He would become the new Carlos, his services, the services required by those who sought them. As you sought them, monsieur. Moulmein, Tokyo, Calcutta. Jason heard the names coming from his lips, whispered from his throat. Again they were floating, suspended in the perfumed air, shadows of a past forgotten. Manila, Hong Kong.
He stopped, trying to clear the mists, peering at the outlines of strange shapes that kept racing across his mind's eye.
These places and many others, continued Lavier.
That was Kane's era, his era still. Carlos may be many things to many people,
But among those who have benefited from his trust and generosity, there is loyalty. His informers and hirelings are not so readily for sale, although Cain has tried time and again. It is said that Carlos is swift to make harsh judgments, but as they also say, better a Satan one knows than a successor one doesn't. What Cain did not realize, does not realize now, is that Carlos' network is a vast one. When Cain moved to Europe, he did not know that his activities were uncovered in Berlin, Lisbon, Amsterdam, as far away as Oman.
Oman, said Bourne involuntarily. Sheikh Mustafa Kalik, he whispered, as if to himself.
Never proven, interjected the Lavier woman defiantly. A deliberate smokescreen of confusion. The contract itself, fiction. He took credit for an internal murder. No one could penetrate that security. A lie.
A lie, repeated Jason.
So many lies, added Madame Lavier contemptuously. He is no fool, however. He lies quietly, dropping a hint here and there, knowing that they will be exaggerated in the telling into substance. He provokes Carlos at every turn, promoting himself at the expense of the man he would replace. But he's no match for Carlos. He takes contracts he cannot fulfill. You are only one example. We hear there have been several others. It's said that's why he stayed away for months, avoiding people like yourselves.
Avoiding people. Jason reached for his wrist. The trembling had begun again, the sound of distant thunder vibrating in far regions of his skull.
You're sure of that?
Very much so.
He wasn't dead. He was in hiding. Cain botched more than one assignment. It was inevitable. He accepted too many in too short a time. Yet whenever he did, he followed an abortive kill with a spectacular unsolicited one to uphold his stature. He would select a prominent figure and blow him away, the assassination a shock to everyone, and unmistakably Cain's. The ambassador traveling in Moman was an example. No one had called for his death. There were two others that we know of, a Russian commissar in Shanghai, and more recently a banker in Madrid.
The words came from the bright red lips working feverishly in the lower part of the powdered mask facing him. He heard them. He had heard them before. He had lived them before. They were no longer shadows, but remembrances of that forgotten past. Images and reality were fused. She began no sentence he could not finish, nor could she mention a name or a city or an incident with which he was not instinctively familiar. She was talking about him.
Alpha, Bravo, Cain, Delta. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. Jason Bourne was the assassin called Cain. There was a final question, his brief reprieve from darkness 2 nights ago at the Sorbonne. Marseille, August 23rd.
What happened in Marseille? He asked.
Marseille? The Lavier woman recoiled. How could you? What lies were you told? What other lies?
Just tell me what happened.
You refer to Leland, of course. The ubiquitous ambassador whose death was called for, paid for, the contract accepted by Carlos.
What if I told you that there are those who think Cain was responsible?
It's what he wanted everyone to think. It was the ultimate insult to Carlos, to steal the kill from him. Payment was irrelevant to Cain. He only wanted to show the world, our world, that he could get there first and do the job for which Carlos had been paid. But he didn't, you know. He had nothing to do with the Leland kill.
He was there.
He was trapped. At least, he never showed up. Some said he'd been killed, But since there was no corpse, Carlos didn't believe it. How was Cain supposedly killed? Madame Lavier retreated, shaking her head in short, rapid movements. Two men on the waterfront tried to take credit, tried to get paid for it. One was never seen again. It can be presumed Cain killed him, if it was Cain. They were duck garbage. What was the trap? The alleged trap, monsieur. They claimed to have gotten word that Cain was to meet someone in the Rue Saracen a night or so before the assassination. They say they left appropriately obscure messages in the street and lured the man they were convinced was Cain down to the piers, to a fishing boat. Neither trawler nor skipper were seen again, so they may have been right. But as I say, there was no proof. Not even an adequate description of Cain to match against the man led away from the Saracen. At any rate, that's where it ends. You're wrong. That's where it began. For me.
I see, said Bourne, trying again to infuse naturalness into his voice. Our information's different, naturally. We made a choice on what we thought we knew.
The wrong choice, monsieur. What I've told you is the truth.
Yes, I know.
Do we have our compromise, then?
Why not?
Bien.
Relieved, the woman lifted the wine glass to her lips.
You'll see. It will be better for everyone.
It doesn't really matter now. He could barely be heard, and he knew it.
What did he say? What had he just said? Why did he say it?
The mists were closing in again, the thunder getting louder. The pain had returned to his temples.
I mean, as you say, it's better for everyone.
He could feel, see Lavier's eyes on him, studying him. It's a reasonable solution.
Of course it is. You are not feeling well?
I said it was nothing. It'll pass.
I'm relieved. Now would you excuse me for a moment?
No. Jason grabbed her arm.
Je vous prie, monsieur. The powder room, that is all. If you care to, stand outside the door.
We'll leave. You can stop on the way. Bourne signaled the waiter for a check.
As you wish,
she said, watching him. He stood in the darkened corridor between the spills of light that came from recessed lamps in the ceiling. Across the way was the ladies' room, denoted by small, uncapitalized letters of gold that read, Femme. Beautiful people, stunning women, handsome men kept passing by. The orbit was similar to that of Les Classiques. Jacqueline Lavier was at home. She had also been in the ladies' room for nearly 10 minutes. A fact that would have disturbed Jason had he been able to concentrate on the time. He could not. He was on fire. Noise and pain consumed him, every nerve ending raw, exposed, the fibers swelling, terrified of puncture. He stared straight ahead, a history of dead men behind him. The past was in the eyes of truth. They had sought him out, and he had seen them.
Cain. Cain.
Cain. He shook his head and looked up at the black ceiling. He had to function. He could not allow himself to keep falling, plunging into the abyss filled with darkness and high wind. There were decisions to make. No. They were made. It was a question now of implementing them.
Marie. Marie. Oh, God, my love, we've been so wrong.
He breathed deeply and glanced at his watch, the chronometer he had traded for a thin gold piece of jewelry belonging to a marquis in the south of France.
He is a man of immense skill, extremely inventive.
There was no joy in that appraisal. He looked across at the ladies' room. Where was Jacqueline Lavier? Why didn't she come out? What could she hope to accomplish remaining inside? He had had the presence of mind to ask the maitre d' if there was a telephone there. The man had replied negatively, pointing to a booth by the entrance. The Lavier woman had been at his side. She heard the answer, understanding the inquiry. There was a blinding flash of light. He lurched backward, recoiling into the wall, his hands in front of his eyes. The pain. Oh, Christ! His eyes were on fire. And then he heard the words, spoken through the polite laughter of well-dressed men and women walking casually about the corridor. In memory of your dinner at Roger's, monsieur, said an animated hostess, holding a press camera by its vertical flash bar. The photograph will be ready in a few minutes. Compliments of Roger. Bourne remained rigid, knowing that he could not smash the camera, the fear of another realization sweeping over him. Why me? He asked. Your fiancé requested it, monsieur, replied the girl, nodding her head toward the ladies' room. We talked inside. You are most fortunate. She is a lovely lady. She asked me to give you this. The hostess held out a folded note. Jason took it as she pranced away toward the restaurant entrance. Your illness disturbs me, as I'm sure it does you, my new friend. You may be what you say you are. And then again, you may not. I shall have the answer in a half hour or so. A telephone call was made by a sympathetic diner, and that photograph is on its way to Paris. You cannot stop it any more than you can stop those driving now to Argenteuil. If we indeed have our compromise, neither will disturb you, as your illness disturbs me, and we shall talk again when my associates arrive. It is said that Cain is a chameleon, appearing in various guises and most convincing. It is also said that he is prone to violence and to fits of temper. These are an illness, no? He ran down the dark street in Argenteuil after the receding roof light of the taxi. It turned the corner and disappeared. He stopped, breathing heavily, looking in all directions for another. There were none. The doorman at Roger's had told him a cab would take 10 to 15 minutes to arrive. Why had not Monsieur requested one earlier? The trap was set, and he had walked into it. Up ahead. A light. Another taxi. He broke into a run. He had to stop it. He had to get back to Paris. To Marie. He was back in a labyrinth, racing blindly, knowing finally there was no escape. But the race would be made alone. That decision was irrevocable. There would be no discussion, no debate, no screaming back and forth. Arguments based in love and uncertainty. For the certainty had been made clear. He knew who he was, what he had been. He was guilty as charged, as suspected. An hour or two saying nothing, just watching. Talking quietly about anything but the truth. Loving. And then he would leave. She would never know when, and he could never tell her why. He owed her that. He would hurt deeply for a while, but the ultimate pain would be far less than that caused by the stigma of Cain. Cain. Marie. Marie. What have I done? Taxi! Taxi! Chapter 18. Get out of Paris. Now. Whatever you're doing, stop it and get out. Those are orders from your government. They want you out of there. They want him isolated. Marie crushed out her cigarette in the ashtray on the bedside table, her eyes falling on the 3-year-old issue of Potomac Quarterly, her thoughts briefly on the terrible game Jason had forced her to play. I won't listen, she said to herself out loud, startled at the sound of her own voice in the empty room. She walked to the window, the same window he had faced, looking out, frightened, trying to make her understand. I have to know certain things, enough to make a decision, but maybe not everything. A part of me has to be able to run, disappear. I have to be able to say to myself, what was isn't any longer, and there's a possibility that it never was because I have no memory of it. What a person can't remember didn't exist.
for him.
My darling, don't let them do this to you.
Her spoken words did not startle now, for it was as though he were there in the room listening, heeding his own words, willing to run, disappear with her. But at the core of her understanding she knew he could not do that. He could not settle for a half-truth or three-quarters of a lie. They want him isolated.
Who were they?
The answer was in Canada, and Canada was cut off. Another trap. Jason was right about Paris. She felt it too. Whatever it was here. If they could find one person to lift the shroud and let him see for himself he was being manipulated, then other questions might be manageable, the answers no longer pushing him toward self-destruction. If he could be convinced that whatever unremembered crimes he had committed, he was a pawn for a much greater single crime, he might be able to walk away, disappear with her. Everything was relative. What the man she loved had to be able to say to himself was not that the past no longer existed, but that it had, and he could live with it and put it to rest. That was the rationalization he needed, the conviction that whatever he had been was far less than his enemies wanted the world to believe, for they would not use him otherwise. He was the scapegoat, his death to take the place of another's. If he could only see that. If she could only convince him. And if she did not, she would lose him. They would take him. They would kill him. They.
Who are you?
She screamed at the window, at the lights of Paris outside.
Where are you?
She could feel a cold wind against her face as surely as if the panes of glass had melted, the night air rushing inside. It was followed by a tightening in her throat, and for a moment she could not swallow, could not breathe. The moment passed and she breathed again. She was afraid. It had happened to her before, on their first night in Paris, when she had left the café to find him on the steps of the Cluny. She had been walking rapidly down the Saint-Michel when it happened. The cold wind, the swelling of the throat. At that moment she had not been able to breathe. Later she thought she knew why. At that moment also, several blocks away inside the Sorbonne, Jason had raced to a judgment that in minutes he would reverse. But he had reached it then. He had made up his mind he would not come to her.
Stop it, she cried.
It's crazy, she added, shaking her head, looking at her watch. He had been gone over 5 hours.
Where was he?
Where was he? Bourne got out of the taxi in front of the seedily elegant hotel in Montparnasse. The next hour would be the most difficult of his briefly remembered life. A life that was a void before Port Noir, a nightmare since. The nightmare would continue, but he would live with it alone. He loved her too much to ask her to live it with him. He would find a way to disappear, taking with him the evidence that tied her to Cain. It was as simple as that. He would leave for a non-existent rendezvous and not return. And sometime during the next hour, he would write her a note. It's over. I've found my arrows. Go back to Canada and say nothing for both our sakes. I know where to reach you. The last was unfair. He would never reach her. But the small, feathered hope had to be there, if only to get her on a plane to Ottawa. In time. With time, their weeks together would fade into a darkly kept secret, a cache of brief riches to be uncovered and touched at odd, quiet moments. And then no more, for life was lived for active memories. The dormant ones lost meaning. No one knew that better than he did. He passed through the lobby, nodding at the concierge, who sat on his stool behind the marble counter, reading a newspaper. The man barely looked up, noting only that the intruder belonged. The elevator rumbled and groaned its way up to the 5th floor. Jason breathed deeply and reached for the gate. Above all, he would avoid dramatics. No alarms raised by words or by looks.
The chameleon had to merge with his quiet part of the forest, one in which no spores could be found. He knew what to say. He had thought about it carefully, as he had the note he would write. "Most of the night walking around," he said, holding her, stroking her dark red hair, cradling her head against his shoulder, and aching, chasing down cadaverous clerks, listening to animated nonsense, and drinking coffee disguised as sour mud. Les Classiques was a waste of time. It's a zoo. The monkeys and the peacocks put on a hell of a show, but I don't think anyone really knows anything. There's one outside possibility, but he could simply be a sharp Frenchman in search of an American mark. "He?" asked Marie, her trembling diminished. "A man who operated the switchboard," said Bourne, repelling images of blinding explosions and darkness and high winds as he pictured the face he did not know, but knew so well. That man now was only a device. He pushed the images away. "I agreed to meet him around midnight at the Bastring on Rue Hautefeuille."
"What did he say?"
"Very little, but enough to interest me. I saw him watching me while I was asking questions. The place was fairly crowded, so I could move around pretty freely, talk to the clerks."
"Questions? What questions did you ask?"
"Anything I could think of. Mainly about the manager, or whatever she's called. Considering what happened this afternoon, if she were a direct relay to Carlos, she should have been close to hysterics. I saw her. She wasn't. She behaved as if nothing had happened except a good day in the shop."
"But she was a relay, as you call it. D'Amacour explained that. The fiche."
"Indirect. She gets a phone call and is told what to say before making another call herself. Actually, Jason thought, the invented assessment was based on reality. Jacqueline Lavier was indeed an indirect relay."
"You couldn't just walk around asking questions without seeming suspicious," protested Marie.
"You can," answered Bourne, "if you're an American writer doing an article on the stores in Saint-Honoré for a national magazine."
"That's very good, Jason."
"It worked. No one wants to be left out."
"What did you learn?"
"Like most of those kinds of places, Les Classiques has its own clientele, all wealthy, most known to each other, and with the usual marital intrigues and adulteries that go with the scene. Carlos knew what he was doing. It's a regular answering service over there, but not the kind listed in a phone book."
"People told you that?"
asked Marie, holding his arms, watching his eyes. "Not in so many words," he said, aware of the shadows of her disbelief. "The accent was always on this Bergeron's talent, but one thing leads to another. You can get the picture. Everyone seems to gravitate to that manager. From what I've gathered, she's a font of social information, although she probably couldn't tell me anything except that she did someone a favor, an accommodation, and that someone will turn out to be someone else who did another favor for another someone. The source could be untraceable, but it's all I've got."
"Why the meeting tonight at Bastring?"
"He came over to me when I was leaving and said a very strange thing." Jason did not have to invent this part of the lie. He had read the words on a note in an elegant restaurant in Argenteuil less than an hour ago. "He said, you may be what you say you are, and then again you may not." That's when he suggested a drink later on, away from Saint-Honoré. Bourne saw her doubts receding. He had done it. She accepted the tapestry of lies. And why not? He was a man of immense skill, extremely inventive. The appraisal was not loathsome to him. He was Cain.
"He may be the one, Jason. You said you only needed one. He could be it."
"We'll see." Bourne looked at his watch. The countdown to his departure had begun. He could not look back. "We've got almost 2 hours. Where did you leave the attaché case?"
at the Maurice. I'm registered there. Let's pick it up and get some dinner. You haven't eaten, have you?
No.
Marie's expression was quizzical. Why not leave the case where it is? It's perfectly safe. We wouldn't have to worry about it.
We would if we had to get out of here in a hurry, he said almost brusquely, going to the bureau.
Everything was a question of degree now. Traces of fiction gradually slipping into speech, into looks, into touch. Nothing alarming, nothing based on false heroics. She would see through such tactics. Only enough so that later she would understand the truth when she read his words. It's over. I've found my arrows.
What's the matter, darling?
Nothing. The chameleon smiled. I'm just tired and probably a little discouraged.
Good heavens, why? A man wants to meet you confidentially late at night. A man who operates a switchboard. He could lead you somewhere. And you're convinced you've narrowed Carlos' contact down to this woman? She's bound to be able to tell you something, whether she wants to or not. In a macabre way, I think you'd be elated.
I'm not sure I can explain it, said Jason, now looking at her reflection in the mirror. You'd have to understand what I found there.
What you found?
A question. What I found. A statement. It's a different world, continued Bourne, reaching for the bottle of scotch and a glass. Different people. It's soft and beautiful and frivolous, with lots of tiny spotlights and dark velvet. Nothing's taken seriously except gossip and indulgence. Any one of those giddy people, including that woman, could be a relay for Carlos and never know it, never even suspect it. A man like Carlos would use such people. Anyone like him would, including me. That's what I found. It's discouraging.
And unreasonable. Whatever you believe, those people make very conscious decisions. That indulgence you talk of demands it. They think. And you know what I think? I think you are tired and hungry. I need a drink or two. I wish you could put off tonight. You've been through enough for one day.
I can't do that, he said sharply.
All right, you can't, she answered defensively.
Sorry, I'm edgy.
Yes, I know.
She started for the bathroom.
I'll freshen up and we can go. Pour yourself a stiff one, darling. Your teeth are showing.
Marie? Yes? Try to understand. What I found there upset me. I thought it would be different. Easier.
While you were looking, I was waiting, Jason. Not knowing. That wasn't easy either.
I thought you were going to call Canada, didn't you? She held her place for a moment.
No, she said. It was too late.
The bathroom door closed. Bourne walked to the desk across the room. He opened the drawer, took out stationery, picked up the ballpoint pen, and wrote the words. It's over. I've found my arrows. Go back to Canada and say nothing for both our sakes. I know where to reach you. He folded the stationery, inserted it into an envelope, holding the flap open as he reached for his billfold. He took out both the French and the Swiss bills, slipping them behind the folded note, and sealed the envelope. He wrote on the front, Marie. He wanted so desperately to add, my love, my dearest love. He did not. He could not. The bathroom door opened. He put the envelope in his jacket pocket. That was quick, he said.
Was it? I didn't think so. What are you doing?
I wanted a pen, he answered, picking up the ballpoint. If that fellow has anything to tell me, I want to be able to write it down. Marie was by the bureau. She glanced at the dry, empty glass.
You didn't have your drink?
I didn't use the glass.
I see,
Shall we go?
They waited in the corridor for the rumbling elevator, the silence between them awkward, in a real sense, unbearable. He reached for her hand. At the touch, she gripped his, staring at him, her eyes telling him that her control was being tested and she did not know why. Quiet signals had been sent and received, not loud enough or abrasive enough to be alarms, but they were there, and she had heard them. It was part of the countdown, rigid, irreversible, prelude to his departure.
Oh, God, I love you so. You are next to me, and we are touching, and I am dying. But you cannot die with me. You must not. I am Cain.
We'll be fine, he said. The metal cage vibrated noisily into its recessed perch. Jason pulled the brass grill open, then suddenly swore under his breath.
Oh, Christ, I forgot.
What? My wallet. I left it in the bureau drawer this afternoon in case there was any trouble in Saint-Honoré. Wait for me in the lobby. He gently swung her through the gate, pressing the button with his free hand. I'll be right down. He closed the grill, the brass latticework cutting off the sight of her startled eyes. He turned away and walked rapidly back toward the room. Inside, he took the envelope out of his pocket and placed it against the base of the lamp on the bedside table. He stared down at it, the ache unendurable.
Goodbye, my love, he whispered.
Bourne waited in the drizzle outside the Hotel Maurice on the Rue de Rivoli, watching Marie through the glass doors of the entrance. She was at the front desk, having signed for the attaché case, which had been handed to her over the counter. She was now obviously asking a mildly astonished clerk for her bill, about to pay for a room that had been occupied less than 6 hours. 2 minutes passed before the bill was presented. Reluctantly. It was no way for a guest at the Maurice to behave. Indeed, all Paris shunned such inhibited visitors. Marie walked out on the pavement, joining him in the shadows and the mist-like drizzle to the left of the canopy. She gave him the attaché case, a forced smile on her lips, a slight breathless quality in her voice.
That man didn't approve of me. I'm sure he's convinced I used the room for a series of quick tricks.
What did you tell him? Asked Bourne.
That my plans had changed, that's all.
Good. The less said, the better. Your name's on the registration card. Think up a reason why you were there.
Think up?
I should think up a reason? She studied his eyes, the smile gone. I mean, we'll think up a reason. Naturally.
Naturally.
Let's go. They started walking toward the corner, the traffic noisy in the street, the drizzle in the air fuller, the mist denser, the promise of heavy rain imminent. He took her arm, not to guide her, not even out of courtesy, only to touch her, to hold a part of her. There was so little time.
I am Cain.
I am death.
Can we slow down? Asked Marie sharply.
What? Jason realized he had been practically running. For a few seconds he had been back in the labyrinth, racing through it, careening, feeling and not feeling. He looked up ahead and found an answer. At the corner, an empty cab had stopped by a garish newsstand, the driver shouting through an open window to the dealer. I want to catch that taxi, said Bourne, without breaking stride. It's going to rain like hell. They reached the corner, both breathless as the empty cab pulled away, swinging left into Rue de Rivoli. Jason looked up into the night sky, feeling the wet pounding on his face, unnerved. The rain had arrived. He looked at Marie in the gaudy lights of the newsstand. She was wincing in the sudden downpour. No, she was not wincing. She was staring at something. Staring in disbelief, in shock, in horror. Without warning, she screamed, her face contorted, the fingers of her right hand pressed against her mouth. Bourne grabbed her, pulling her head into the damp cloth of his topcoat. She would not stop screaming. He turned, trying to find the cause of her hysterics. Then he saw it,
and in that unbelievable split half-second he knew the countdown was aborted. He had committed the final crime. He could not leave her. Not now. Not yet. On the first ledge of the newsstand was an early morning tabloid, black headlines electrifying under the circles of light. Slayer in Paris. Woman sought in Zurich killings. Suspect in rumored theft of millions. Under the screaming words was a photograph of Marie Saint-Jacques.
"Stop it," whispered Jason, using his body to cover her face from the curious news dealer, reaching into his pocket for coins. He threw the money on the counter, grabbed two papers, and propelled her down the dark, rain-soaked street. They were both in the labyrinth now.
Bourne opened the door and led Marie inside. She stood motionless, looking at him, her face pale and frightened, her breathing erratic, an audible mixture of fear and anger.
"I'll get you a drink," said Jason, going to the bureau.
As he poured, his eyes strayed to the mirror, and he had an overpowering urge to smash the glass, so despicable was his own image to him. What the hell had he done? Oh, God. I am Cain. I am death.
He heard her gasp and spun around, too late to stop her, too far away to lunge and tear the awful thing from her hand. Oh, Christ, he had forgotten. She had found the envelope on the bedside table and was reading his note. Her single scream was a searing, terrible cry of pain.
Jason!
Please.
No!
He raced from the bureau and grabbed her.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't count anymore.
He shouted helplessly, seeing the tears swelling in her eyes, streaking down her face.
Listen to me. That was before, not now. You were leaving. My God, you are leaving me.
Her eyes went blank, two blind circles of panic.
I knew it. I felt it.
I made you feel it, he said, forcing her to look at him. But it's over now. I won't leave you. Listen to me. I won't leave you. She screamed again.
I couldn't breathe. It was so cold.
He pulled her to him, enveloping her. We have to begin again. Try to understand. It's different now, and I can't change what was, but I won't leave you. Not like this.
She pushed her hands against his chest, her tear-stained face angled back, begging,
Why, Jason? Why?
Later. Not now. Don't say anything for a while. Just hold me. Let me hold you.
The minutes passed, hysteria ran its course, and the outlines of reality came back into focus. Bourne led her to the chair. She caught the sleeve of her dress on the frayed lace. They both smiled as he knelt beside her, holding her hand in silence.
How about that drink? He said finally.
I think so,
she replied, briefly tightening her grip on his hand as he got up from the floor.
You poured it quite a while ago.
It won't go flat. He went to the bureau and returned with two glasses half filled with whiskey. She took hers.
Feeling better? He asked.
Calmer? Still confused? Frightened, of course. Maybe angry, too, I'm not sure. I'm too afraid to think about that.
She drank, closing her eyes, her head pressed back against the chair.
Why did you do it, Jason?
Because I thought I had to. That's the simple answer.
And no answer at all. I deserve more than that.
Yes, you do, and I'll give it to you. I have to now, because you have to hear it. You have to understand. You have to protect yourself.
Protect?
He held up his hand, interrupting her. It'll come later. All of it, if you like. But the first thing we have to do is know what happened. Not to me, but to you. That's where we have to begin. Can you do it?
The newspaper?
Yes.
God knows I'm interested, she said, smiling weakly.
Here,
Jason went to the bed where he had dropped the two papers. We'll both read it.
No games?
No games. They read the long article in silence, an article that told of death and intrigue in Zurich. Every now and then Marie gasped, shocked at what she was reading. At other times she shook her head in disbelief. Born said nothing. He saw the hand of Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez. Carlos will follow Cain to the ends of the earth. Carlos will kill him. Marie Saint-Jacques was expendable, a baited decoy that would die in the trap that caught Cain. I am Cain. I am death. The article was, in fact, two articles, an odd mixture of fact and conjecture, speculations taking over where evidence came to an end. The first part indicated a Canadian government employee, a female economist, Marie Saint-Jacques. She was placed at the scene of three murders, her fingerprints confirmed by the Canadian government. In addition, police found a hotel key from the Carillon du Lac, apparently lost during the violence on the Gison Quay. It was the key to Marie Saint-Jacques' room, given to her by the hotel clerk, who remembered her well, remembered what appeared to him to be a guest in a highly disturbed state of anxiety. The final piece of evidence was a handgun discovered not far from the Stepdeckstrasse, in an alley close by the scene of two other killings. Ballistics held it to be the murder weapon, and again there were fingerprints, again confirmed by the Canadian government. They belonged to the woman, Marie Saint-Jacques. It was at this point that the article veered from fact. It spoke of rumors along the Bahnhofstrasse that a multi-million dollar theft had taken place by means of a computer manipulation dealing with a numbered, confidential account belonging to an American corporation called Treadstone 71. The bank was also named. It was, of course, the Gemeinschaft. But everything else was clouded, obscure, more speculation than fact. According to unnamed sources, an American mail holding the proper codes transferred millions to a bank in Paris, assigning the new account to specific individuals who were to assume rights of possession. The assignees were waiting in Paris, and upon clearance, withdrew the millions and disappeared. The success of the operation was traced to the Americans obtaining the accurate codes to the Gemeinschaft account, a feat made possible by penetrating the bank's numerical sequence related to year, month, and day of entry. Standard procedure for confidential holdings. Such an analysis could only be made through the use of sophisticated computer techniques and a thorough knowledge of Swiss banking practices. When questioned, an officer of the bank, Herr Walther Apfel, acknowledged that there was an ongoing investigation into matters pertaining to the American company, but pursuant to Swiss law, the bank would have no further comment to anyone. Here, the connection to Marie Saint-Jacques was clarified. She was described as a government economist extensively schooled in international banking procedures, as well as a skilled computer programmer. She was suspected of being an accomplice, her expertise necessary to the massive theft. And there was a male suspect. She was reported to have been seen in his company at the Carillon du Lac. Marie finished the article first and let the paper drop to the floor. At the sound, Bourne looked over from the edge of the bed. She was staring at the wall, a strange, pensive serenity having come over her. It was the last reaction he expected. He finished reading quickly, feeling depressed and hopeless, for a moment speechless. Then he found his voice and spoke. "Lies," he said, "and they were made because of me, because of who and what I am. Smoke you out, they find me. I'm sorry. Sorrier than I can ever tell you." Marie shifted her eyes from the wall and looked at him. "It goes deeper than lies, Jason," she said. "There's too much truth for lies alone." "Truth? The only truth is that you were in Zurich. You never touched a gun. You were never in an alley near the Stepdeckstrasse. You didn't lose a hotel key, and you never went to the Gemeinschaft."
"Agreed. But that's not the truth I'm talking about."
"Then what is?"
"The Gemeinschaft. Treadstone 71.
up for? Those are true, and the fact that any were mentioned, especially Apfel's acknowledgement, is incredible. Swiss bankers are cautious men. They don't ridicule the laws, not this way. The jail sentences are too severe. The statutes pertaining to banking confidentiality are among the most sacrosanct in Switzerland. Apfel could go to prison for years for saying what he did, for even alluding to such an account, much less confirming it by name. Unless he was ordered to say what he did by an authority powerful enough to contravene the laws. She stopped, her eyes straying to the wall again. Why? Why was the Gemeinschaft, or Treadstone, or Apfel ever made part of the story? I told you. They want me, and they know we're together. Carlos knows we're together. Find you, he finds me. No, Jason. It goes beyond Carlos. You really don't understand the laws in Switzerland. Not even a Carlos could cause them to be flaunted this way. She looked at him, but her eyes did not see him. She was peering through her own mists. This isn't one story. It's two. Both are constructed out of lies, the first connected to the second by tenuous speculation. Public speculation on a banking crisis that would never be made public unless and until a thorough and private investigation proved the facts. And that second story, the patently false statement that millions were stolen from the Gemeinschaft, was tacked onto the equally false story that I am wanted for killing three men in Zurich. It was added. Deliberately. Explain that, please. It's there, Jason. Believe me when I tell you that. It's right in front of us. What is? Someone's trying to send us a message.
Chapter 19. The army sedan sped south on Manhattan's East River Drive, headlights illuminating the swirling remnants of a late winter snowfall. The major in the back seat dozed, his long body angled into the corner, his legs stretched out diagonally across the floor. In his lap was a briefcase, a thin nylon cord attached to the handle by a metal clamp, the cord itself strung through his right sleeve and down his inner tunic to his belt. The security device had been removed only twice in the past 9 hours. Once during the major's departure from Zurich, and again with his arrival at Kennedy Airport. In both places, however, U.S. government personnel had been watching the customs clerks, more precisely watching the briefcase. They were not told why. They were simply ordered to observe the inspections, and at the slightest deviation from normal procedures, which meant any undue interest in the briefcase, they were to intercede, with weapons, if necessary. There was a sudden, quiet ringing. The major snapped his eyes open and brought his left hand up in front of his face. The sound was a wrist alarm. He pressed the button on his watch and squinted at the second radium dial of his two-zoned instrument. The first was on Zurich time, the second, New York. The alarm had been set 24 hours ago when the officer had received his cabled orders. The transmission would come within the next 3 minutes. That is, thought the major, it would come if Iron Ass was as precise as he expected his subordinates to be. The officer stretched, awkwardly balancing the briefcase, and leaned forward, speaking to the driver. Sergeant, turn on your scrambler to 1430 megahertz, will you please? Yes, sir. The sergeant flipped two switches on the radio panel beneath the dashboard, then twisted the dial to the 1430 frequency. There it is, Major. Thanks. Will the microphone reach back here? I don't know. Never tried it, sir. The driver pulled the small plastic microphone from its cradle and stretched the spiral cord over the seat. Guess it does, he concluded. Static erupted from the speaker, the scrambling transmitter electronically scanning and jamming the frequency. The message would follow in seconds. It did. Treadstone? Treadstone, confirm, please. Treadstone receiving, said Major Gordon Webb. You're clear. Go ahead. What's your position?
About a mile south of the Triborough, East River Drive, said the Major.
Your timing is acceptable, came the voice from the speaker.
Glad to hear it. It makes my day. Sir.
There was a brief pause, the Major's comment not appreciated. Proceed to 139 East 71st. Confirm by repeat. 139er East 71st. Keep your vehicle out of the area. Approach on foot.
Understood.
Out.
Out.
Webb snapped the transmission button in place and handed the microphone back to the driver.
Forget that address, Sergeant. Your name's on a very short file now.
Gotcha, Major. Nothing but static on that thing anyway. But since I don't know where it is and these wheels aren't supposed to go there, where do you want to be dropped off?
Webb smiled. No more than 2 blocks away. I'd go to sleep in the gutter if I had to walk any further than that.
How about Lex and 72nd?
Is that 2 blocks?
No more than 3.
If it's 3 blocks, you're a private.
Then I couldn't pick you up later, Major. Privates aren't cleared for this duty.
Whatever you say, Captain.
Webb closed his eyes. After 2 years, he was about to see Treadstone 71 for himself. He knew he should feel a sense of anticipation. He did not. He felt only a sense of weariness, of futility. What had happened? The incessant hum of the tires on the pavement below was hypnotic, but the rhythm was broken by sharp intrusions where concrete and wheels were not compatible. The sounds evoked memories of long ago, of screeching jungle noises woven into a single tone. And then the night. Night, when blinding lights and staccato explosions were all around him and below him, telling him he was about to die. But he did not die. A miracle wrought by a man had given his life back to him. And the years went on, that night, those days never to be forgotten. What the hell had happened?
Here we are, Major.
Webb opened his eyes, his hand wiping the sweat that had formed on his forehead. He looked at his watch, gripped his briefcase, and reached for the handle of the door.
I'll be here between 2300 and 2330 hours, Sergeant. If you can't park, just cruise around and I'll find you.
Yes, sir. The driver turned in his seat.
Could the Major tell me if we're going to be driving any distance later?
Why? Have you got another fare?
Come on, sir. I'm assigned to you until you say otherwise, you know that.
But these heavy-plated trucks use gas like the old-time Shermans. If we're going far, I'd better fill it.
Sorry.
The Major paused.
Okay. You'll have to find out where it is anyway, because I don't know.
We're going to a private airfield in Madison, New Jersey. I have to be there no later than 100 hours.
I've got a vague idea, said the driver.
At 2330, you're cutting it pretty close, sir.
Okay. 2300, then.
And thanks. Webb got out of the car, closed the door, and waited until the brown sedan entered the flow of traffic on 72nd Street. He stepped off the curb and headed south to 71st. 4 minutes later, he stood in front of a well-kept brownstone, its muted, rich design in concert with those around it in the tree-lined street. It was a quiet street. A moneyed street. Old money. It was the last place in Manhattan a person would suspect of housing one of the most sensitive intelligence operations in the country. And as of 20 minutes ago, Major Gordon Webb was one of only 8 or 10 people in the country who knew of its existence. Treadstone 71.
He climbed the steps, aware that the pressure of his weight on the iron grids embedded in the stone beneath him triggered electronic devices that in turn activated cameras, producing his image on screens inside. Beyond this, he knew little, except that Treadstone 71 never closed. It was operated and monitored 24 hours a day by a select few, Identity is unknown. He reached the top step and rang the bell, an ordinary bell, but not for an ordinary door. The major could see that. The heavy wood was riveted to a steel plate behind it. The decorative iron designs, in actuality, the rivets. The large brass knob disguising a hot plate that caused a series of steel bolts to shoot across into steel receptacles at the touch of a human hand when the alarms were turned on. Webb glanced up at the windows. Each pane of glass, he knew, was an inch thick, capable of withstanding the impact of 30-caliber shells. Treadstone 71 was a fortress. The door opened, and the major involuntarily smiled at the figure standing there, so totally out of place did she seem. She was a petite, elegant-looking, gray-haired woman with soft, aristocratic features and a bearing that bespoke moneyed gentility. Her voice confirmed the appraisal. It was mid-Atlantic, refined in the better finishing schools, and at innumerable polo matches. "How good of you to drop by, Major. Jeremy wrote us that you might. Do come in. It's such a pleasure to see you again." "It's good to see you again, too," replied Webb, stepping into the tasteful foyer, finishing his statement when the door was closed. "But I'm not sure where it was we met before." The woman laughed. "Oh, we've had dinner ever so many times." "With Jeremy?" "Of course." "Who's Jeremy?" "A devoted nephew who's also your devoted friend. Such a nice young man. It's a pity he doesn't exist." She took his elbow as they walked down a long hallway. "It's all for the benefit of neighbors who might be strolling by. Come along now, they're waiting." They passed an archway that led to a large living room. The major looked inside. There was a grand piano by the front windows, harp beside it, and everywhere, on the piano and on polished tables glistening under the spill of subdued lamps, were silver-framed photographs, mementos of a past filled with wealth and grace. Sailboats, men and women on the decks of ocean liners, several military portraits. And yes, two candid shots of someone mounted for a polo match. It was a room that belonged in a brownstone on this street. They reached the end of the hallway. There was a large mahogany door, bas-relief and iron ornamentation part of its design, part of its security. If there was an infrared camera, Webb could not detect the whereabouts of the lens. The gray-haired woman pressed an unseen bell. The major could hear a slight hum. "Your friend is here, gentlemen. Stop playing poker and go to work. Snap to, Jesuit." "Jesuit?" asked Webb, bewildered. "An old joke," replied the woman. "It goes back to when you were probably playing marbles and snarling at little girls." The door opened, and the aged but still erect figure of David Abbott was revealed. "Glad to see you, Major," said the former silent monk of covert services, extending his hand. "Good to be here, sir." Webb shook hands. Another elderly, imposing-looking man came up beside Abbott. "A friend of Jeremy's, no doubt," said the man, his deep voice edged with humor. "Dreadfully sorry. Time precludes proper introductions, young fellow. Come along, Margaret. There's a lovely fire upstairs." He turned to Abbott. "You'll let me know when you're leaving, David?"